of Kieran. I love them both in different ways, but with no less intensity. Emma spoke carefully. Are they asking you to choose between them? Christina looked off toward the sunset, stripes of gold and red above the trees. No. No, they are not asking me to choose.
I see, said Emma, who was not sure she did see. Then...
We decided it was impossible, Christina said. Kieran, Mark, and I, we are all afraid. If we were together, the way we want to be, we would bring misery on those we love.
Misery? Why?
Emma's hands were shaking again. She shoved them between her knees so Christina wouldn't see.
Kieran fears for Fairy, Christina said. After so many terrible kings, after so much cruelty, he wishes to go back and take up a place in the court and see to the welfare of his people. He cannot turn away from that, and neither Mark nor I would want him to. But for us, we cannot know the future. Even if the cohort is gone, it does not mean the end of the Cold Peace. Mark is afraid for Helen, for all of the Blackthorns, that if he were involved with the Prince of Faerie and everyone knew it, his family would be punished. I fear the same for my family, so it would never work. Do you understand?
Emma twirled a piece of grass between her fingers.
I would never judge you, she said.
First because it's you, and second because I hardly have the right to judge anyone.
But I think you're letting your fear get in the way of what you really want, because what you really want is what you're afraid of.
Christina blinked.
What do you mean?
From the outside, here's what I see, said Emma. When Mark and Kieran are alone together, they get pulled into their difficult past. It consumes them. When Mark and you are together, he worries that he isn't good enough for you, no matter what you say. And when Kieran and you are together, sometimes you can't bridge the gulf between Shadowhunter understanding and Fairy understanding. Mark helps you bridge that gulf. The sun was nearly down, the sky a deep blue, Christina's expression lost in shadow.
Does that seem wrong?
No, Christina said after a long pause.
But it doesn't...
You're afraid of what everyone is afraid of, said Emma. Having your hearts broken, being made miserable by love.
But what you're saying, that's what the cohort wants.
They want to make people afraid, to make them stay apart because they have created an environment of fear and suspicion where you can be punished for being with someone you love. If they got their way, they'd punish Alec for being with Magnus. But that doesn't mean Magnus and Alec should split up. Am I making sense?
A little too much sense, Christina said, pulling out a loose thread on her sleeve.
I know one thing for sure, Emma said. Christina, of all the people I know, you are the most generous, and you spend the most time thinking about what makes other people happy. I think you should do whatever makes you happy. You deserve it.
Thanks, Christina gave her a shaky smile. What about you and Julian? How are you doing?
Emma's stomach lurched, surprising her. It was as if hearing the words, you and Julian, had set something off inside her. She pushed down on the feeling, trying to control it.
It's really hard, she whispered. Julian and I can't even talk to each other. And the best we can hope for after all this is over is some kind of exile.
I know. Christina took Emma's hand in hers. Emma tried to still her own shaking. Christina's reassuring touch helped. For the millionth time, Emma wished she'd met Christina earlier, that Christina could have been her parabatai.
After the exile, if it happens, come stay with me, wherever I am, Mexico, anywhere. I'll take care of you.
Emma made a sound halfway between a laugh and a sniffle.
That's what I mean. You're always doing things for other people, Tina.
Okay, well, then I'm going to ask you to do something for me.
What? I'll do anything.
Unless it makes your mom mad. Your mom scares me.
You want to kill Zara in the battle if there's a fight, don't you? Christina said.
thought had crossed my mind. Okay, yes. If anyone else takes her out, I'm going to be really angry. Emma mock scowled.
Christina sighed.
We don't even know if there's going to be a fight, Emma. If Zara is spared or imprisoned or escapes, or if someone else kills her, I don't want you to dwell on it. Revenge only comes back to hurt you. Focus on what you want your life to be after tomorrow. After tomorrow, I'll be exiled, Emma thought. Will I see you again, Christina? Will I always miss you?
Christina narrowed her eyes in concern. Emma, promise me. But before Emma could promise, before she could say anything at all, Aline's and Helen's voices cut through the evening air, calling them down to dinner.
Has anyone ever tried ketchup on a s'more? Isabel said. This is why you're a bad cook, said Alec.
Simon, bundled up in a sweater and leaning back against a log, slunk down as if he hoped to become invisible.
You actually like disgusting food. It's not like an accident.
I like ketchup and s'mores, said Simon loyally and mouthed to Clary. I don't like them.
I know, Clary said. I can feel through the parabatai bond how much you don't like them.
Julian is an excellent cook, said Emma, spearing a marshmallow.
Magnus had produced bags of them along with the requisite chocolate and graham crackers. He gave Emma a dark look that seemed to say, stay away from Julian and also his cooking.
I am also an excellent cook, said Mark, putting an acorn on his s'more.
Everyone stared.
He can't help it, said Christina loyally. He has lived in the wild hunt for so long.
I don't do that, said Kieran, eating a s'more in the correct fashion. Mark has no excuse.
I never pictured shadow hunters eating s'mores, said Kit, glancing around the fire. It was like a scene out of dreams of camping that he'd had when he was a little kid. The fire, the trees, everyone bundled up in sweaters and sitting around on logs, smoke in their eyes and hair. On the other hand, this is the first s'more I've ever had that didn't come out of a box.
That's not a s'more then, Ty said. That's a cookie, or some cereal.
Kit smiled, and Ty smiled back at him. He leaned against Julian, who was sitting beside him. Julian put an absent arm around his younger brother, his hand ruffling Ty's hair.
Excited for your first battle? Jace said to Kit. Jace was sitting cross-legged with his arms around Clary, who was creating a massive s'more out of several chocolate bars.
He's not going, Clary said. He's too young, Jace. She looked at Kit. Don't listen to him.
He seems old enough, said Jace. I was fighting battles when I was 10.
Stay away from my children, said Magnus. I'm watching you, Herondale.
Kit felt a brief jolt before realizing Magnus wasn't talking to him. Then another when he realized he'd reacted unconsciously to the name Herondale.
This is great, said Helen, yawning. I haven't been camping in so long.
You can't go camping on Wrangell Island. Your fingers will turn to icicles and snap right off. Emma frowned.
Where's Christina?
Kit glanced around. Emma was right. Christina had slipped away from the group.
She shouldn't be walking around the edge of the forest, Magnus said, frowning. There are booby traps there. Quite well hidden, if I do say so myself.
He started to rise. I'll get her. Mark and Kieran were already on their feet.
We'll find her, Mark said hastily. In the hunt, we learned much about traps.
A few know more about the ways of the forest than the Fae, said Kieran.
Magnus shrugged, but there was a knowing spark in his eye that Kit didn't quite understand.
All right, go ahead.
As they vanished into the shadows, Emma smiled and placed another marshmallow on a stick.
Let's make a toast, Aline raised a plastic cup of water. To never being parted from our families again, she gazed at the fire.
Once tomorrow comes, we're never going to let the clave do that to any of us again.
Not to be parted from family or friends, said Helen, raising her glass.
Or parabatai, said Simon, winking at Clary.
Alec and Jace cheered, but Julian and Emma were silent.
Emma seemed bleakly sad, staring down into her cup of water. She did not seem to see Julian, who looked at her for a single long moment before wrenching his gaze away.
To never being parted, Kit said, looking across the campfire at Ty. Ty's thin face was limned in light from the red-gold flames. To never being parted, he said, with a grave emphasis that made Kit shiver for reasons that he did not understand. Maris could no longer return to the Inquisitor's house, as Horace and Zara had moved into it. Instead, she took Drew and the others to the Greymark house, the one Clary said she had stayed in when she'd first come to Idris. Drew had gone to bed as soon as she politely could. She lay with the covers tucked up to her chin, looking at the last bits of sunlight fading from the circular windows. This side of the house faced onto a garden full of roses, the color of old lace. The trellis climbed to the windows and circled them. At the height of summer, they probably looked like necklaces of roses. Houses of old stone fell away down the hill toward the walls of Alicante, walls that tomorrow would be lined with shadow hunters facing the imperishable fields. Drew burrowed farther under the covers. She could hear Maris in the next room singing to Max and Rafe and Tavi, a lilting song in French. It was strange to be too old for singing to comfort you, but too young to take part in battle preparations. She started to say their names to herself as a sort of good luck charm. Jules and Emma, Mark and Helen, Ty and Liv... No, not Livy. The singing had stopped. Drew heard footsteps in the hall and a door open. Maris stuck her head in. Is everything all right, Drusilla? Do you need anything? Drew would have liked a glass of water, but she didn't know exactly how to talk to Max and Rafe's imposing, dark-haired grandmother. She'd heard Maris playing with Tavi earlier, and she appreciated how kind this woman, who was basically a stranger, was being to them. She just wished she knew how to say it. No, that's okay, Drew said. I don't need anything. Maris leaned against the door jamb. I know it's hard, she said. When I was young, my parents always used to take my brother Max with them to hunt demons and leave me alone at home. They said I'd be frightened if I went with them. I always tried to tell them I was more frightened worrying they'd never come back. Drew tried to picture Maris young and couldn't quite. She seemed old to Drew to even be a mom, though she knew she wasn't. She was actually quite a young grandmother. But Drew had gotten used to people who looked like Julian and Helen being like mothers and fathers to her. They always did come back, though, Maris said. And so will your family. I know it feels like what Julian is doing is risky, but he's smart. Horace won't try anything dangerous in front of so many people. I should go to sleep, Drew said in a small voice, and Maris sighed, giving her an understanding nod and closed the door. If she were home, a small voice said in the back of Drew's mind, she would have had to ask for anything. Helen, who knew she loved tea, but that the caffeine kept her up, would have come in with a mug of the special decaffeinated blend they'd bought in England, with milk and honey in the mug, the way Drew liked it. She missed Helen, Drew realized. It was a weird feeling. Somewhere along the way, her resentment toward Helen had vanished. Now she just wished she'd said a better goodbye to her older sister before she'd left the Institute. Maybe it was better she hadn't said the right kind of goodbyes to her family. Maybe it meant she was definitely going to see them again. Maybe it meant they'd be more forgiving when they found out what she was planning to do. The light blinked out in the hall. Maris must be going to sleep. Drew threw off the blanket. She was fully dressed underneath, down to her boots and gear jacket. She slid off the bed and went over to the circular window. It was stuck shut, but she'd been expecting that. Taking a small dagger with an adamas blade out of her pocket, she started to jimmy it open. Kit lay awake in the darkness, counting the stars he could see through the open flap of the tent. Emma and Julian had said the stars in Faerie were different, but here in Idris they were the same. The same constellations he had looked at all his life, peeking through the smog above Los Angeles, shone above Broslin Forest. The air was clear here, clear as cut crystal, and the stars seemed almost alarmingly close, as if he could reach out and catch one in his hand. Ty hadn't come back with him from the campfire. Kit didn't know where he was. Had he gone to talk to Jules or Helen? Was he wandering in the forest? No. Simon and Isabel would have stopped him. But maybe Ty had found an animal he liked in the campsite. Kit's mind started to race.
Where is he? Why didn't he take me with him? What if he can't tame these squirrels the way he can the ones at home? What if he's attacked by squirrels?
With a groan, Kit kicked off his covers and reached for a jacket. Ty stuck his head into the tent, momentarily blotting out the stars.
Oh, good. You're already getting ready. Kit lowered his voice. What do you mean I'm getting ready? Ready for what?
Ty dropped into a crouch and peered into the tent.
To go to the lake. Ty, said Kit, I need you to explain. Don't assume I know what you're talking about.
Ty exhaled with enough force to make his dark fringe of hair flutter above his forehead.
I brought the spell with me, and all the ingredients, he said. The best place to raise the dead is by the water. I thought we'd do it next to the ocean, but Lake Lynn's even better. It's already a magical place.
Kit blinked dizzily. He felt as if he'd woken up from a nightmare, only to discover he was still dreaming.
But we don't have what we need to make the spell work. Shade never gave us a catalyst. I thought he might not do it, said Ty. That's why I picked up an alternate energy source last time we were at the Shadow Market.
He reached into his pocket and took out a clear glass ball the size of an apricot. Red-orange flame blazed inside it, as if it were a small fiery planet, though it was clearly cool to the touch. Kit jerked back.
Where did that come from? I told you, the Shadow Market.
Kit felt a wave of panic.
Who sold that to you? How do we even know it'll work?
It has to. Ty slipped the crystal back into his pocket.
Kit, this is something I have to do. If there's a battle tomorrow, you know we're not going to be part of it. They think we're too young to fight. This is the way I can help that isn't fighting. If I bring Livy back, our family will be whole for the battle. It will mean that everyone will be happy again.
But happiness isn't that simple, Kit wanted to cry. You can't rip it apart and put it back together again without seeing the seams. Kit's voice was ragged.
It's dangerous, Ty. It's too dangerous. I don't think it's a good idea to mess around with this kind of magic, with an unknown power source.
Ty's expression closed down. It was like watching a door shut. I've already scouted for traps. I know how we can get there. I thought you would come with me, but even if you don't, I'm going alone. Kit's mind raced.
I could wake up the camp and get Ty in trouble, he thought. Julian would stop him, I know he would.
But Kit's whole mind revolted at the idea. If there was one thing his father had brought him up to understand, it was that everyone hated a snitch.
And besides, he couldn't bear to look at Ty's face. All right, Kit said, feeling dread settle in his stomach like a rock. I'll go with you.
Shapes danced in the heart of the fire. Emma sat on a log nearby, her hands thrust into the sleeves of her oversized sweater to keep them warm. The group had drifted away from the fire when the meal was done, retiring to their individual tents to sleep. Emma stayed where she was, watching the fire die down. She supposed she could have gone back to her own tent, but Christina wasn't there, and Emma didn't feel much like lying alone in the dark. She glanced up as a shadow approached. It was Julian. She recognized him by the way he walked, even before the firelight illuminated his face. Hand in his pocket, his shoulders relaxed and his chin upturned. Deceptively casual. The damp in the cool air had curled his hair against his cheeks and temples.
Julian hid so many things from so many people.
Now, for the first time, she was hiding something from him.
Was this how he always felt? The weight in his chest? The pinching pain at his heart?
She half expected him to pass her by without speaking, but he paused, his fingers toying with the sea glass bracelet on his wrist. Are you all right? He asked, his voice low. Emma nodded. Sparks from the fire reflected in Julian's blue eyes. I know we shouldn't talk to each other, he said, but we need to discuss something with someone. It's not about you or me.
I can't do it, Emma thought. You don't understand. You still think we could get my mark stripped if things went wrong. But then again, her rune hadn't burned since they'd left Los Angeles. The black webbing on her forearm hadn't grown. It was as if her misery were holding the curse back. Maybe it was. Who's it about?
It's about one of the things we learned in Thule, he said. It's about Diana.
Diana woke from dreams of flying to the sound of scratching at the door of her tent. She rolled out of her blankets and caught up a knife, rising to a crouch. She heard the sound of two voices, one rising over the other.
Octopus.
She had a vague memory that this was the code word they had all chosen earlier. She put her knife away and went to unzip the flap of the tent. Emma and Julian stood on the other side, blinking in the dark, pale and wide-eyed like startled meerkats. Diana raised her eyebrows at them. Well, if you want to come in, come in. Don't just stand there letting all the cold air in. The tents were just high enough to stand up in, unfurnished by anything but rugs and bedding. Diana sank back into the nest of her covers while Julian leaned against her pack and Emma sat cross-legged on the floor.
Sorry for waking you up, said Julian, ever the diplomat. We didn't know when else we might get to talk to you.
She couldn't help yawning. Diana always slept surprisingly well the night before a battle. She knew shadow hunters who couldn't get sleep, who stayed awake with pounding hearts, but she wasn't one of them.
Talk to me about what?
I want to apologize, Julian said, as Emma worried at the frayed knee of her jeans.
Emma didn't seem like herself. Hadn't for a while now, Diana thought. Not since they'd come back from that other world, though an experience like that would change anyone.
For pushing you to be the head of the Institute.
Diana narrowed her eyes.
What brought this on?
The Thule version of you told us about your time in Bangkok, Emma said, biting her lip. But you don't have to talk about anything to us if you don't want to.
Diana's first reaction was a reflex.
No, I don't want to talk about this, not now. Not on the eve of a battle, not with so much on her mind, not while she was worrying about Gwyn and trying not to think about where he was or what he might do tomorrow.
And yet, she'd been on her way to tell Emma and Julian precisely what they were asking about now, when she'd found out she couldn't reach them. She recalled her disappointment. She'd been determined then. She didn't owe them the story, but she owed it to herself to tell it. They both sat quietly, looking at her. The night before a battle, and they had come to her for this. Not for reassurance, but to let her know it was her choice to engage or not to. She cleared her throat.
So you know I'm transgender. Do you know what that means?
Julian said, We know that when you were born, you were assigned a gender that does not reflect who you actually are. Something in Diana loosened. She laughed. Someone's been on the internet, she said.
Yeah,
that's right, more or less.
And when you were in Bangkok, you used mundane medicine, said Emma, to become who you really are.
Baby girl, I've always been who I really am, said Diana. In Bangkok, Katerina Loss helped me find doctors who would change my body to represent who I am, and people who were like me, to help me understand I wasn't alone. She settled back against the rolled-up jacket she'd been using as a pillow. Let me tell you the story.
And, in a quiet voice, she did.
She didn't vary the telling much from the story she'd told Gwyn, because that story had eased her heart. She watched their expressions as she spoke. Julian, calm and silent. Emma reacting to every word with widened eyes or bitten lips. They'd always been like this. Emma expressing what Julian couldn't or wouldn't. So alike and so different. But it was Julian who spoke first when she was finished.
I'm sorry about your sister, he said. I'm so sorry.
She looked at him in a little surprise. But then, of course, that would be what would strike a chord with Jules, wouldn't it?
In some ways, the hardest part of any of it was not being able to talk about Arya, she said. Gwyn knows, right? Emma said. And he was good about it? He's kind to you, right?
She sounded as fierce as Diana had ever heard her.
He is, I promise, Diana said.
For someone who reaps the dead, he's surprisingly empathic.
We won't tell anyone unless you want us to, Emma said. It's your business. I worry that they find out about my medical treatment if I ever try to become institute head, said Diana. That I'd be taken away from you children, punished with exile. Her hands tightened in her lap. But the Inquisitor found out anyway. Emma sat up straight.
He did? When?
Before I fled Idris. He threatened to expose me to everyone as a traitor.
He is such a bastard, Julian said. His face was tight.
Are you angry with me, Diana said, for not telling you before?
No, Julian said, his voice quiet and firm. You had no obligation to do that, not ever.
Emma scooted closer to Diana, her hair a pale halo in the moonlight streaming through the tent flap.
Diana, these past 5 years, you've been the closest thing I've had to an older sister. And since I met you, you've shown me the kind of woman I want to grow up to be.
She reached out and took Diana's hand.
I feel so grateful and so privileged that you wanted to tell us your story.
Agreed, said Julian.
He bent his head like a knight acknowledging a lady in an old painting. I'm sorry I pushed you. I didn't understand. I thought of you as an adult. Someone who couldn't possibly have problems or be in any danger. I was so focused on the kids that I didn't realize you were all so vulnerable.
Diana touched his hair lightly, the way she often had when he was younger.
That's growing up, isn't it? Figuring out that adults are people with their own issues and secrets. She smiled wryly as Helen stuck her head in through the still unzipped flap.
Oh, good, you're up, she said. I wanted to go over who's staying behind tomorrow.
I've got a list, Julian said, sliding his hand into the pocket of his jacket.
Emma got to her feet, murmuring that she needed to go find Christina. She slipped out the door of the tent, stopping only to glance back once at Julian as she went, but he was deep in conversation with Helen and didn't seem to notice.
Something was going on with that girl, Diana thought.
Once they'd gotten through tomorrow, she'd have to find out what it was.
Chapter 29. Tempt the Waters.
Christina.
Christina!
Voices rang through the woods below.
Surprised, Christina stood up, peering down into the darkness. It had been too painful at the campfire, looking at Mark and at Kieran. Knowing she was counting down hours until one or both of them left her life forever. She had slipped away to sit among the trees and grass and shadows of Brosland. There were white flowers here, among the green, native to Idris. She had seen them before only in pictures, and to touch their petals gave her a feeling of peace, though her sorrow remained beneath it. Then she heard the voices, Mark and Kieran, calling for her. She had been sitting at the top of a green rise of grass between the trees. She rose, brushed herself off, and hurried down the hill toward the sound of her name.
Estoy aquí,
she called, nearly tripping as she rushed down the hill.
I'm right here.
They burst from the shadows, both white-faced. Mark found her first and swung her up off her feet, hugging her tightly. After a moment, he released her to Kieran's arms as they tried to explain. Something about Magnus and traps and being afraid she'd fallen into a pit lined with knives.
I would never do that,
she protested as Kieran stroked her hair back from her face.
Mark, Kieran, I think we were wrong.
Kieran let her go immediately.
Wrong about what?
Mark was standing next to Kieran, their shoulders just brushing. Her boys, Christina thought, the ones she loved. She could not choose between them any more than she could choose between night and day, nor did she wish to.
Wrong that it's impossible, she said. I should have said it before. I was afraid. I did not want to be hurt. Isn't that what we all fear? That we would be hurt? We keep our hearts in prison, in terror that if we let them go free in the world, they would be injured. But I do not want to be in prison. And I think you feel the same, but if you do not,
In his soft, husky voice, Mark said,
I love both of you, and I could not say I love one of you the most, but I am afraid. The loss of both of you would kill me, and here it seems I'm risking having my heart broken, not once but twice. Not all love ends in heartbreak, said Christina.
You know what I want, Kieran said. I was the one to say it first. I love and desire you both. Many are happy like this in Faerie. It is common, such marriages.
Are you proposing to us? Said Mark with a crooked grin, and Kieran turned bright red.
There is one thing, he said. The King of Faerie can have no human consort. You both know that.
It doesn't matter right now, Christina said fiercely. You're not king yet, and if you ever are, we will find a way.
Mark inclined his head, a Faerie gesture.
As Christina says.
My heart goes with her words, Kieran.
I want to be with you both, said Christina. I want to be able to kiss you both and to hold you both. I want to be able to touch you both, sometimes at the same time, sometimes when we are just two. I want you to be able to kiss and hold each other because it makes you happy, and I want you to be happy. I want us to be together, all three.
I think of each of you all the time. I long for you when you are not there.
The words seemed to burst from Kieran like undammed water. He touched Mark's face with his long boned fingers, light as the brush of wind on grass. He turned to Christina next and, with his other hand, caressed her cheek. She could feel that he was shaking. She put her hand over his, pressing it to her face.
I have never wanted anything so desperately as this.
Mark placed his own hand over Kieran's.
I too. I believe in this, in us. Love wakens love. Faith wakens faith.
He smiled at Christina.
All this time we were waiting for you. We loved each other, and it was a great thing, but with you, it is even greater.
Kiss me then,
Christina whispered, and Mark pulled her close and kissed her warmly, then hotly. Kieran's hands were on her back, in her hair. She leaned her head against him as he and Mark kissed over her shoulder, their bodies cradling hers, their hands linked in each other's.
Kieran was smiling like his face would break. They were all kissing each other and laughing with happiness and touching each other's faces with wondering fingers.
I love you,
Christina said to both of them, and they said it back to her at the same time, their voices mingling so she was not sure who spoke first or last.
I love you, I love you, I love you.
Kit had seen Lake Lynn before in pictures. The endless images of the angel rising out of it with the mortal instruments that were inside every Shadow Hunter building, on every wall and tapestry. It was a different thing entirely in real life. It moved like an oil slick under the moonlight. The surface was silver-black, but shot through with bursts of chromatic splendor, streaks of violet blue and hot red, ice green and bruised violet. For the first time when Kit imagined the angel Raziel, massive and blank-faced, rising out of the water, he felt a shiver of awe and fear. Ty had set up his ceremonial circle by the edge of the lake, where the water lapped at a shallow sandy beach. It was actually two circles, one smaller within another larger, and in the border between the circles, Ty had etched dozens of runes with a pointed stick. Kit had seen ceremonial circles before, often in his own living room. But how had Ty become an expert at making them? His circles were neater than Johnny's had ever been, his etchings more careful. He wasn't using Shadowhunter runes, but a runic language that looked far spikier and more unpleasant. Was this where Ty had gone all those times Kit had turned around to find him gone, learning how to be a dark magician? Ty had also set up their ingredients in neat rows beside him, the myrrh, the chalk, Libby's baby tooth, the letter from Thule. Kit wasn't sure if they were arranged in a ceremonial order or if they were just in the order Ty preferred. Having placed the velvet bag containing a lock of Libby's hair carefully among the other objects, Ty looked up at Kit,
who was standing close to the water's edge. Did I do it right? A wave of reluctance came over Kit. The last thing he wanted to do was get close to the magic circle. How would I know?
Well, your father was a magician. I thought he might have taught you some of this, Ty said.
Kit kicked at the edge of the water. Luminous sparks flew up.
Actually, my dad kind of kept me away from learning real spells. But I know a little.
He scuffed across the beach toward Ty, who was sitting with his legs crossed on the sand. Kit had often thought night and darkness seemed like Ty's natural environment. He disliked direct sunlight, and his pale skin looked as if it had never been burned. In moonlight, he shone like a star.
With a sigh, Kit pointed at the glowing red ball Ty had gotten from the shadow market.
The catalyst goes in the middle of the circle. Ty was already picking it up. Come sit next to me, he said. Kit knelt down as Ty started to place the objects into the ceremonial circle, murmuring in a low voice as he did so. He reached up, undid the chain of the locket, handed it to Kit. With a deep sense of dread, Kit placed the locket near the edge of the circle. Ty began to chant more loudly.
Abyssus abyssum, invocat invoce, cataractarum tuarum. Omnia excelsetua, et fluctus tui super, me transierunt.
Deep calls to deep in the voice of your waterfalls. All your whirlpools and waves have passed over me.
As he chanted, one by one, the objects in the circle caught fire, like fireworks going off in a row. They burned with a clean white blaze without being consumed. A strong wind started to blow off the lake. It smelled of loam and grave dirt. Kit started to hear a clamor of voices and twisted around, staring. Was someone there? Had they been followed? But he saw no one. The beach was deserted.
Do you hear that? He whispered.
Ty only shook his head, still chanting. The lake shimmered, the water moving. Pale, white figures rose from the dark water. Many were in gear, some in more old-fashioned armor. Their hair flowed down and around them, translucent in the moonlight. They reached their arms out toward him, toward Ty, who could not see them. Their lips moved silently.
This is really happening,
Kit thought, chilled to the bone. Whatever tiny hope he'd had this wouldn't work had vanished. He turned to Ty, who was still chanting, spitting out the memorized words like machine gun fire.
Hic mortui we want. Hic mortui we want.
Ty, stop!
His hands shot out, grabbed Ty's shoulders. He knew he shouldn't. Ty didn't like to be startled, but terror was fizzing in his blood like poison.
Ty, don't do this!
The Latin choked off mid-sentence. Ty stared at Kit, confused, his gray eyes darting from Kit's collarbone to his face and back down again.
What do you mean? I don't understand. Don't do this. Don't raise her from the dead.
But I have to, Ty said. His voice sounded stretched, like a wire pulled taut.
I can't live without Livy.
Yes, you can, Kit whispered.
You can. You think this will make your family stronger, but it will destroy them if you bring her back. You think you can't survive without Livy, but you can. We will go through it together.
Kit's face was cold. He realized he was crying.
I love you, Ty. I love you.
Ty's face went blank with surprise. Kit plowed on, regardless, hardly knowing what he was saying.
She's gone, Ty. She's gone forever. You have to get through this. Your family will help you. I will help you, but not if you do this. Not if you do this, Ty.
The blankness was gone from Ty's face, his mouth twisted, as if he were trying to hold in tears. Kit knew the feeling. He hated seeing it on Ty's face. He hated everything that was happening.
I have to get her back, Kit, Ty whispered.
He pulled away from Kit's grasp, turned back toward the circle, where the various objects were still burning. The air was full of the scent of char.
Ty!
Kit said, but Ty was already chanting Latin again, his hands outstretched to the circle.
Igni ferroque excellentio ex animo.
Kit threw himself at Ty, knocking him onto the sand. Ty tumbled backward without a struggle, too surprised to defend himself. They rolled down the slight incline toward the water. They splashed into the shadows, and Ty seemed to come back to life. He shoved at Kit, elbowing him hard in the throat. Kit coughed and let go. He grabbed for Ty again, and Ty kicked at him. He could see Ty was crying. But even crying, he was a better fighter than Kit was. Though Ty looked fragile as moonbeams, he was a shadow hunter born and trained. He struggled free and darted up the sand toward the circle, thrusting his hand out to the fire.
Excellentio! Ex animo!
He shouted, panting.
Livia Blackthorn! Resurget! Resurget! Resurget!
The flame in the center of the circle turned black. Kit sank back on his heels, tasting blood in his mouth. It was over. The spell was done. The dark flames rose toward the sky. Ty stepped back, staring, as they roared upward. Kit, who had seen dark magic before, staggered to his feet. Anything could have gone wrong, he thought grimly. If they had to run, he'd knock Ty out with a rock, drag him away. The water of the lake began to ripple. Both boys turned to look, and Kit realized the shimmering dead were gone. There was only one transparent figure now, rising out of the water, her hair long and streaming silver. The outline of her face, her eyes, came clear. Her floating hair, a locket around her throat, the drifting white dress that didn't seem like something Livy would have chosen. Livy, Kit whispered. Ty ran to the edge of the lake. He stumbled, fell to his knees at the waterline as Libby's ghost made its way toward them across the water, scattering luminous sparks. She reached the banks of the lake. Her bare feet trailed in the glowing water. She looked down at Ty, her body transparent as a cloud, her expression unfathomably sad.
Why have you disquieted me?
She said in a voice as sorrowful as winter wind.
Livy,
Ty said. He reached a hand out as if he could touch her. His fingers passed through the skirt of her dress.
It's not really her,
Kit wiped blood from his face.
She's a ghost.
Relief battled with misery in his chest.
She wasn't undead.
But surely raising a ghost against its will wasn't a good idea either.
Why aren't you here? Said Ty, his voice rising. I did everything right. I did everything right.
The catalyst you used was corrupted. It wasn't strong enough to fully bring me back, Livy said.
It might have other consequences as well, Ty. But you can stay with me, right? You can stay with me like this,
Ty interrupted. The outlines of Livy's body blurred as she swayed toward her brother.
Is that what you want? Yes. That's why I did all this, Ty said. I want you to be with me in any way you can be. You were there with me before I was born, Livy. Without you, I just... There's nothing if you aren't there.
There's nothing if you aren't there. Pity and despair ripped through Kit. He couldn't hate Ty for this, but he would never mean anything to Ty. And never had. That much was clear.
I loved you, Ty. I loved you even when I was dead, said Livy's ghost. But you have upended the universe, and we will all pay for it. You've ripped a hole in the fabric of life and death. You don't know what you've done.
Tears ran down Livy's face and splashed into the water, individual glowing drops like sparks of fire.
You cannot borrow from death. You can only pay for it,
she vanished.
Livy!
Ty didn't scream the word so much as it was ripped from him. He curled up, hugging himself, as if desperate to keep his body from shattering apart. Kit could hear Ty crying, awful, dark sobs that sounded pulled out of him. An hour ago, he would have moved heaven to make it stop. Now, he was unable to take a step. His own pain, a searing agony that held him frozen in place. He looked up at the ceremonial circle. The flames were burning white again. The objects inside were beginning to be consumed. The velvet bag turned to ash. The tooth blackened. The chalk and myrrh destroyed. Only the necklace still gleamed whole and unharmed. As Kit watched, the letter from Thule caught fire and the words on the page flared up to burn a glowing black before vanishing.
I love you. I love you. I love you.
At the door of the guard prison, Drew paused, picks in hand. She was breathing hard from her climb up the hill. She hadn't taken the normal paths, but crept through the underbrush, staying out of sight. Her wrists and ankles were torn from the whiplash scratches of branches and thorns. She barely felt the pain. Now was the moment of reckoning. On the other side of this action, there was no turning back. No matter how young she was, if Horace and the others prevailed and learned what she'd done, she'd be punished. Julian's voice echoed in her ears. You were part of Livia's watch. Don't forget it. Livy wouldn't have hesitated, Drew knew. She would have hurtled forward, desperate to right any injustice she saw. She would never have held back. She would never have hesitated. Livy, this is for you, my sister.
I love you. I love you. I love you.
She went to work on the lock.
The entrance to the Silent City was just as Emma remembered it. A barely marked trail passing through the corner of Brosselin Forest, surrounded by thick greenery. It was clear that few passed this way, and rarely. Her witchlight revealed a path almost unmarked by footsteps. She could hear the twitter of nightbirds and the movement of small animals among the trees. But something was missing from Brosselin. It had always been a place where one might have expected to see the glint of will-o'-the-wisps among the leaves or hear the crackle of a campfire around which werewolves were gathered. There was something very present about its current silence, something that made Emma walk with extra care.
The trees grew together more thickly as she reached the mountainside and found the door in among the rocks. It looked just as it had 3 years ago, pointed at the top and carved with the bas-relief of an angel. A heavy brass knocker hung from the wood. Acting mostly on instinct, Emma reached behind her and drew the mortal sword from its scabbard. It had a weight in her hand that no other sword, not even Cortana, had, and it gleamed in the night as if it emitted its own light. She had taken it from Julian's tent where it had been hidden beneath the bedroll, wrapped in a velvet cloth. She had replaced it with another sword. It wouldn't pass close examination, but he had no reason to be racing to the tent every 5 minutes to check on it. After all, the camp was guarded. She placed her hand against the door. Brother Shadrach's message had said that the Silent City would be empty tonight, the Silent Brothers serving as guards on the city walls the night before the parley. And still the door seemed to pulse against her palm, as if it beat like a heart.
I am Emma Carstairs. And I bear the mortal sword, she said.
Open, in the name of Malartok. For an agonizingly long moment, nothing happened. Emma began to panic. Maybe the mortal sword of Thule was different somehow, its atoms too altered, its magic alien. The door opened all at once, soundlessly, like a mouth yawning open. Emma slipped inside, glancing once over her shoulder at the silent forest.
The door slid shut behind her with the same silence, and Emma found herself in a narrow, smooth-walled passage that led to a staircase going down. Her witch light seemed to bounce off the marble walls as she descended, feeling as if she were passing through memory. The silent city in Thule, empty and abandoned. Circles of fire in rooms of bones as she sealed her parabatai ritual with Julian. Her greatest mistake. The one that had ended with this journey. She shivered as she came out to the main part of the city, where the walls were lined in skulls and femurs and delicate chandeliers of bones hung from the ceiling. At least in Thule, she hadn't been alone. At last, she entered the room of the speaking stars. It was just as it had been in her dream. The floor glimmered like the night sky turned upside down, the stars curving in a parabola before the basalt table where the silent brother sat when in session. The table was bare, and no sword hung behind it in its usual place. Emma stepped onto the stairs, her boots clanking softly against the marble. In her dream, the floor had simply opened. Now, nothing happened. She rubbed at her exhausted eyes with her knuckles, feeling inside herself for the instinct that had guided her in opening the door to the city. I am a parabatai, she thought. The magic that binds me to Julian is woven into this place, into the fabric of Nephilim. Hesitantly, she touched a finger to the blade of the mortal sword, ran her fingertip down it gently, letting her memory fall back to that moment she had stood in the fire with Julian. Thy people shall be my people. Thy God shall be my God. A bead of blood formed on her fingertip and splashed down onto the marble at her feet. There was a click, and the floor, which had appeared seamless, opened and slid back, revealing a black gap below it. In the gap was a tablet. She could see it far more clearly than she had in her dream. It was made of white basalt, and on it was a parabatai rune, painted in blood so ancient that the blood itself had long dissolved, leaving behind only a red-brown stain in the shape of a rune. Emma's breath caught in her throat. Despite everything, being in the presence of something so old and so powerful caught at her heart. Feeling as if she were choking, she raised the sword in her hands, the tip of the blade pointed downward. She could see herself doing it, driving the sword down, splitting the tablet apart. She imagined the sound of it breaking. It would be the sound of hearts breaking all over the world as parabatai were cut apart. She imagined them reaching for each other in uncomprehending horror. Jace and Alec, Clary and Simon. The pain that Julian would feel. She began to sob silently. She would be an exile, a pariah cast out like Cain. She imagined Clary and the others turning from her with looks of loathing. You couldn't hurt people like that and be forgiven. But she thought again of Diana in Thule. The runes began to burn like fire, as if they had fire in their veins instead of blood. People said that the blades of those who fought them shattered in their hands. Black lines spread over their bodies and they became monstrous, physically monstrous. I never saw it happen, mind you. I heard all this third hand. Stories about ruthless, massive, shining creatures tearing cities apart. Sebastian had to release thousands of demons to take them down. A lot of mundanes and shadow hunters died. She and Julian could not become monsters. They could not destroy everyone they knew and loved. It was better to break the parabatai bonds than to be responsible for death and destruction. It felt like forever since Jem had explained the curse to her. They had tried everything to escape it. Eventually the power would make them mad, until they became monsters. They would destroy their families, the ones they loved. Death would surround them. There was no escape but this. Her hands clamped tighter around the sword's hilt. She raised Malartok. Forgive me, Julian.
Stop!
A voice rang through the Bone City.
Emma, what are you doing?
She turned without moving from the speaking stars or lowering the sword. Julian stood at the entrance to the chamber. He was white-faced, staring at her in total shock. He had clearly been running. He was breathless, leaves in his hair and mud on his shoes.
Don't try to stop me, Julian.
Her voice was barely above a whisper. He held his hands out as if to show they were empty of weapons and took a step forward toward her. She shook her head and he stopped. I always thought this would be me, he said. I never thought it would be you doing this.
Get out of here, Julian. I don't want you to be here for this. If they find me here, I want them to find me alone.
I know, he said. You're sacrificing yourself. You know they'll blame someone. Someone with access to the mortal sword, and you want it to be you. I know you, Emma. I know exactly what you're doing. He took a step toward her. I won't try to stop you, but you can't make me leave you, either.
But you have to,
her voice rose.
They'll exile me, Julian, at best. Even if Horus is overthrown, even Gia wouldn't overlook this. Nobody would or could. They won't understand it. If it's the two of us, they'll think we did it so we could be together. You'll lose the kids. I won't let that happen. Not after everything. Emma.
Julian held his hands out to her. The sea glass bracelet on his wrist glittered. Bright color in this place of bones and grayness. I will not leave you. I will never leave you. Even if you shatter that rune, I won't leave you. A sob tore through Emma. And then another. She slid to her knees, still holding the sword. Despair ripped into her, as strong as relief. Maybe it was relief. She couldn't tell. But she could sense Julian come up quietly and kneel down across from her, his knees against the cold stone.
What happened? He said.
What about the cushion of time, Magnus said we had?
My rune has been burning. And yours too, I know it. And there's this.
She tugged up the sleeve of her sweater, turning her hand over to show him the mark on her forearm. A dark spiderweb pattern, small but growing.
I don't think we have time left.
Then we could get our marks stripped, Julian said. His voice was soft, reassuring. A voice he saved for the people he loved the most. Mine as well as yours.
I thought that... I talked to Jim at the meeting, Emma said. He told me he would never do it, never. And Magnus can't do it alone.
She caught her breath.
In Thule, Diana told me that when Sebastian started to take over, the Parabatai in the world turned to monsters. Their runes burned, and their skin was covered with black marks, and then they became monsters. That's what's happening to us, Julian. I know it is. All that stuff about the curse turning us into monsters. It's like that monstrosity is hidden in the heart of the bond, like a cancer.
There was a long pause. Why didn't you tell me about this?
I didn't believe it at first, she whispered. At least I thought it was something that could only happen in Thule. But our runes have burned. And the black marks on my skin, I knew.
But we don't know, he said softly. I know how you feel. You're shaky, right? Your mind's racing, your heart's racing too. She nodded.
How?
I feel the same way, he said. I do think it's the curse. Jem said it would give us power. And I do feel like I've been lit up with electricity and I can't stop shaking.
But you seem all right, Emma said.
I think recovering from the spell, for me, is like climbing up out of a pit, he said. I'm not quite at the top yet, where you are. I'm a little protected. He looped his arms around his knees. I know why you're scared. Anyone would be. But I'm still going to ask you to do something for me. I'm going to ask you to have faith.
Faith? She said. Faith in what?
In us, he said. Even when you told me why it was forbidden for us to be in love, even when I knew we shouldn't have ever become Parabatai, I still had all the memories of how wonderful it was to be your partner, to have our friendship made into something holy. I still believe in that bond.